of home were burning brightly when I left so long ago.
You're listening to Can't Do Nothing With Love, an award-winning short story collection written and read by Ellen Morris Pruitt. Today's episode features Ain't No Commies Round Here. You see, he was my sister's boy, the first grandbaby in the family, born after Deirdre's husband, Ronald, ran off. The boy was born with a hole in his heart, operated on at birth and again at 4 years. That last one, the anesthesia didn't sit right, and he turned blue, plum colored, really, that ashy plum of a winter sunset when the fields look almost black and the cedars stand out against the sky. The nurse took one look at the boy's color, grabbed him up, and tore off toward the O.R. He'd been in the hospital bed. It was the pre-anesthesia that wasn't right. When she slammed through the double doors, the lifeless body laid across her arms like the crucified Christ. I was right behind, because of Ronald not being around. Deirdre was yelling, "No! No!" Afraid the child was going to slip out of this world. The surgeon's face drained of color when he saw the boy. That shut Deirdre down. She just stood there, her mouth open, but no sound coming out. They got an oxygen tube down him, and he was fine. But after you go through that with the child, you feel you owe him. That was, oh gosh, 20 years ago. Deirdre's been dead 7 years next April, and the boy, Clement is his name, drifted onto his own path. All that money Deirdre saved up for his college went straight to him. Too much for a 17-year-old, if you ask me. He quit schooling and traveled for a while, hitchhiking. I know he grew his hair long. He sent a picture once, several years ago, him standing in the middle of a wheat field. "Outstanding in my field," he wrote on the back of the picture and mailed it to Maureen and me, when there still was a Maureen and me. Wrote Uncle Perry on the envelope, Aunt Maureen. I guess he was thinking about me working the farm, thought a field picture would suit. Maybe he was remembering riding the tractor with me when it came time to bush hog the fields, me driving, him sitting in my lap. He'd ask question after question. "Why are we weaving around?" when I'd break from the straight line to protect the quail's nest from the bush hog's blade. Quaily birds, he called them, and turned to stare at the brushy patches we left untouched in our wake. Back at the house, he'd pick the beggar lice off my white socks. I have that field photo somewhere around here, but his face is so small to get the field in the picture, it wouldn't help much in terms of recognizing him. We were meeting at Chief Tuscumbia's park right off Front Street, the boy's idea. The park was outfitted for Christmas. Santa's train was working, of course. I couldn't remember if we'd taken Clement on Santa's train when he was a kid or not. I can't think that we wouldn't have. Deirdre insisted when it came to that child. Don't know if it was from him having the hole in his heart or on account of Ronald being gone, but it was like she was always making up for something, some slight he'd suffered that she couldn't quite make right. Letting him eat whatever mess he wanted for supper, butter and sugar sandwiches. He was skinny as a chicken. And when the grown-ups gathered, he'd run around the living room squawking. If he'd been a boy of mine, he'd have gotten a talking to, but Deirdre never said a thing. I kept my mouth shut and did my part, if you call cobbling together 115 cardboard bricks for him to play with one Christmas Eve doing your part. Maureen and I never had children of our own, so that made it easier to do for Deirdre's child. The air in the park was cold, cold as it gets in Tuscumbia, Alabama. Colder than other parts of the country, maybe, because we're not used to it. Personally, I like North Alabama better in the winter, with all the colors showing. Black stalks in the resting fields, the red cows breathing white blotches into the morning air. In summertime, Alabama is just green, green, green. Maureen always said that was contrarian of me, and why did I have to be so melancholy anyway? Sounds like a Lady Clairol commercial, she'd say when I described something pretty I'd seen in the fields that day. She was a woman who liked a good chicken pot pie coming hot out of the oven, the chicken juice bubbling, the pie crust flaky. She was happy then, her hands in the oven mitts, her nose sniffing the steam. Somehow, I couldn't give her even as much as the hot chicken pot pie could. The families were fidgeting in line at Santa's train, the kids picking at one another, a slap here, pinch there. Jimmy Jean and Quill Corey were in the line with their grandson. They'd gone to Evergreen Methodist with me and Maureen back when I went to church. Quill owned a construction company, and the two of them always reminded me of a spade and a pickaxe, him squat and square, her thin and sharp. Off to their left, the Channel 7 Eyewitness News van, white with that oversized antenna on top, idled, cables snaking away from the van's wheels. A man was milling around with a camera lifted onto his shoulder. I was scanning the crowd. There was a lump of folks over by the Channel 7 van, as well as the Christmas carolers wandering from the train shed to the carved statue of Chief Tuscumbia, when the boy tapped me on the arm. I had to look up to see who it was. Way up. The boy was tall. Don't know how that happened. Sure wasn't the butter and sugar sandwiches. When I finally caught his face, I startled a bit. Deirdre was all over the boy's features. Her wide mouth and strong nose, those dark eyebrows like slash marks over her eyes, always ready to scold. She was my older sister. "Uncle Perry," he said, recognizing me without any problem, even though I know I was whiter in the head than before, more stooped over. Guess the basic pattern hadn't changed much. "Well," I said and stuck out my hand. Then I clapped him on the back to let him know we were family after all. He gave me a full hug. A sheaf of papers clasped in his hand tickled the back of my neck. When he pulled away, I saw he was wearing an old army jacket with a bright red sweatshirt underneath, and I tried to remember if he'd done a stint in the service. "Welcome home, son," I said, just to be on the safe side. And, too, I was glad to see my only living relative back in Tuscumbia. "Oh," he said, "we're just passing through." He clamped the sheaf of papers between his knees and retied a red handkerchief on his head. The handkerchief reminded me of a pirate, or an Arabian knife thrower, maybe. Didn't think he was either one of those, but who was I to say? My eyes settled on his bright yellow tennis shoes, the only thing that reminded me of the awkward boy I'd once known. "Little Rock to Birmingham, this leg. I asked to stop in the Shoals. Sheila got to see her family in Memphis." He looked around, the tip of his kerchief flipping in the wind like a milkmaid. "Where's Aunt Maureen?" I'd been considering this question ever since I'd gotten his postcard with the picture of the Washington Monument on front, telling me he was coming into town. "Aunt Maureen and Uncle Perry," it read, just like always. "Ain't no more Aunt Maureen, son. She left me, moved over to Mississippi with the man she met at the laundromat when the washer was broke. Like Mississippi could be better for anybody." "Oh," he said. No reason to tell him about the long night since she'd left, when a glass of whiskey and a box of cheese nips had become something to look forward to. "2 years ago," I added. "Oh," he repeated, then squinted his eyes. I thought he was looking at Quill and Jimmy Jean Corey waiting in the Santa line. Maybe recognize them from when I'd taken him to Evergreen Methodist to make sure he'd know church. "But no," he said, when I asked if he remembered them. "He was just thinking." Beside the news van, a young woman in a long black skirt fiddled with a microphone on a podium. Two young people hefted a banner, trying to keep it from torquing in the breeze. "Support the living wage," the black and white banner read. The breeze ruffled my windbreaker while I tried to come up with the next thing to say. The clouds gathered gold with the afternoon sun. The days were so short, soon the dusk would be on us, then the sapphire night. I wanted to ask the boy what he'd been doing with himself, whether he'd been spending time anywhere near about as pretty as North Alabama. Did it hurt his heart to come back and realize how long he'd been away from home? The postmark on the field photo he sent said Sioux City, Iowa, and the Washington Monument postcard was obviously Washington, D.C., The white needle of the monument was pretty, piercing the sky, but I don't know. It looked kind of stiff, not living and breathing like Alabama. "What do you?" I said, but at the exact same time he said on top of it, "Anyway, thanks for coming." The young woman from the podium walked up, positioned herself at his elbow. Clement looked down at the top of her head. She didn't come up to his shoulder. Tight in both hands, she gripped a white poster board. The force of the wind bowed it against her legs. "Does he want a poster?" the young woman asked, her eyes on Clement, as if an old geezer in rolled jeans and a cat hat couldn't hear, much less answer for himself. 30 years ago, I would have called her a hippie. Long, flat hair, no makeup. Work boots, even though I never saw those girls doing any work. Somewhere along the line, they'd reemerged, like 17-year locusts, burrowing out of their deep sleep, singing their siren song into a new day. "A poster?" I asked. "Local support is crucial to success." She swished her long hair behind her back. "It made all the difference in Atlanta." "We had good success in Atlanta," Clement said, gazing at the woman. "Real good success," she said, gazing right back at him. "Well, I started, but the boy got the jump on me again. I think they're ready for us," he said. He and the woman began walking toward the crowd around the podium. When I followed, the boy handed me one of the blue sheets of paper he was toting. "Rally for the Living Wage Campaign," the sheet said across the top. In smaller letters, right below that, song lyrics. The words were different, but if you sounded it out, the tunes were hippie tunes. White people singing like black folk. "Down by the riverside, ain't gonna be poor no more." "What's going on, son?" Clement paused to peer at the song sheet in my hand. "Songs get everyone motivated," he said. Dipping his shoulders, he added, "I'm the song leader. Sheila is posters." The three of us stopped at the edge of the group, a raggedy smattering of folks in odd hats and coats. The young woman, Sheila, lifted her poster over her head and shook it. The poster board sung like an echo. Clement held up his blue papers, raised his voice. "Everyone got a song sheet?" His voice was deeper raised like that. The microphone screeched, and a new woman at the podium, a black lady with a fluffy fur cap, grimaced, then smiled wide. The man with the TV camera trained it on her. When the camera's red light blinked on, the lady called, "What do we want?" The crowd shouted, "A living wage! When do we want it? Now!" Maybe it was the Christmas decorations all around, but living wage sounded like living Christmas tree, where you didn't cut the tree down but decorated it where it grew. That didn't make no sense with a wage, so I asked the boy. The crowd was still busy with the hollering business. "What might a living wage be?" He was shouting, "Now!" His eyes fixed on the podium, but he glanced my way and said, "In Alabama, $28,700 for a family of four." I folded the song sheet in half, working the crease, then unzipped my jacket and tucked it inside. "Take it home with me," I said, when Clement looked at what I was doing. "Souvenir." "We'll be singing soon," he said as the woman at the podium yelled, "Sheila Jacobs!" Sheila struck her poster at me. "Here," she said, and took off for the podium. I turned the poster around to see what it was I was holding on to. In handwritten letters, the poster said, "Families support the living wage." A crescent of men had appeared on our perimeter, Quill Curry at its center. Beside him was Frankie James, the man who'd sold me my tractor and bush hog so long ago. He and Quill stood with their arms crossed against their chests. So did all the other men. Quill caught sight of me and gave me the beady eye. Something in his gaze made me feel like a fraud, so I gave the poster a jiggle. At my feet, the winter grass was yellow and bent. Some, like Maureen, might call its color dead. But it reminded me of the cow's salt lick after it had been in the fields for a while, sides curved by the flat, black tongues of cows. I studied my hands holding the poster board, hatch-marked with thin scratches, impatient when I wouldn't wait to find my chamois gloves and all the clutter in the feed room, and tore at the brambles barehanded. There were some things about myself could stand changing. At the podium, Sheila was spouting like a preacher, calling us her living wage warriors. The tip of her nose had blotted red from the cold or her enthusiasm, I don't know. She had a small face, a small body. If she had a few more pounds on her, she might be cute. The boy obviously thought she was just fine the way she was. "She does a good job," I said to him. "Yeah, it's hard to get people to come to Alabama." He was clapping at something Sheila had said, his gaze never leaving her face. "You folks are one of only six states with no living wage ordinance whatsoever. People don't have a lot of optimism about Alabama." Sheila took a bow, and the boy shot his hands high over his head, clapping. The way he'd said, "Alabama, and you folks," made me glad I hadn't asked him about being homesick. What did I know anyway? Just a lonely old geezer with not much to add to anything. The podium was silent while the new speaker set up. Sheila worked the crowd, shaking hands with those congratulating her on her speech. Clement stuffed the folded blue song sheets into his back pocket, waiting for the girl to make it to our spot. I decided it was probably time to go home. I'd done my part for the boy. No point in dragging it out. Then a voice shouted, "Take your so-called living wage and get the hell out of Alabama. Ain't no commies round here." It was Quill Curry. Several women had joined the men's clump, Jimmy Jean and the grandson with them. The grandson wore a sweatshirt with a cartoon Santa on it, the cartoon too young for his age, even I could tell that. He looked down at the ground when I caught his eye. "Now, fellas," I said in the clump's direction. "Look at you, Radisson." Quill had separated himself from the group. "When did you turn commie?" "Take it easy, dude," Clement called, then laid his hand on my arm. In a low voice, he said, "We're trained. Don't make it personal. Dude! Quill was walking towards us in his hitching gait, his group shadowing behind. How am I supposed to build curbs and gutters, paying my workers the kind of money you're talking about, dude? He was shaking his fist at Clement. What do you damn hippies know about making a living anyway, dude? At that last barked dude, Sheila's head snapped around like a doe hearing the crunch of a hunter's footstep on dead leaves. She trotted towards us, lifting her skirts and clomping in her work boots. The men saw it too, and Quill called out, Mama gonna protect you, dude! Quill's group laughed, even the women, as if things were easing up some. Clement didn't seem to know what to do. He threw his arm around the girl like she was the one under attack. She lifted her chin, the two of them in it together. As if from a long distance away, I could hear the fur-capped woman saying, This living wage of mine, ready? The group began a wavering song. I clamped my hand on Clement's shoulder and called, Quill, Jimmy Jean, this is Deirdre's child, my nephew. Y'all remember Clement, just got back in town and you being ugly to him. Jimmy Jean quit ruffling her grandson's hair and looked up. Quill planted his hands on his hips, jerking his head to the side. Your nephew? The white stubble on his chin quivered. Dried mud caked his blunt-toed boots. Jimmy Jean's ringing hands were chapped bright red. Just like a tree that's planted by the water, the group warbled. We shall not be moved. Of course he is. I flopped my hand to the eyewitness news van. This is all for the cameras. Nothing to get riled up about. Just people singing songs and waving posters. I could feel Clement staring at me, the girl too. No, Uncle Perry, he said, and gave me an unsorted look. You're the one who told me it was important. His eyebrows weren't scolding. They were confused. You part of this crap, Radisson? Quill wanted to know. Behind us, the bell on Santa's train dinged. Son, I never heard of the living wage. Don't know nothing about it. Around us, the sun was setting, making me antsy. I needed to get back to the farm, feed the cows. They'd be lowing, expecting me, their hooves churning the raw, red mud. I'd done right by the boy, coming out to see him. I needed to get back to what I knew. I handed Clement my poster board. You come by the house tonight, you and your girl, and I'll give you some supper. He threw the poster on the ground, startling me. You said it. You said every living thing has the right to raise its family best as it can. You said every.
I did?
This didn't sound a bit like me.
When?
When you drove around the nests, the boy said, wrenching it out. The quaily bird nests, he finished, almost in a whisper. The bush hog in the fields, the shooting summer grass, the tractor with the little boy sitting so straight, important in his job. Me cranking the wheel to avoid the nests on the ground, talking and answering every question he asked about everything I did, explaining as best I could. Why, Uncle Perry? Because nothing deserves to be run over, not when they're trying so hard to make a home for their little family. Then back at the house, the green beggar lice in his cupped palm, glancing up at me, shy. I love you, Uncle Perry, the girl said. Clement! And while she waited, the boy stared at his bright yellow tennis shoes, his face so like the child he'd once been, anxious, squawking, forever hunting for something he couldn't find. Then, while I watched and wondered what to say, the child slipped from beneath the man's features and was gone from the world. I leaned over, grunting, and shook the dirt from the poster. I would have never gone in the direction he did. I didn't even know how he'd gotten there. But he was right and I was wrong. My crusty old heart needed to remember family was about more than doing your duty. If it wasn't too late, maybe I could give the young man standing in front of me cause to love his Uncle Perry as much as the boy once had. I called to Quill and his group. Ain't no commies round here, boys. Just fine, upstanding young men, doing what they think is right. You go on home now. They didn't move, but it didn't matter. I offered the poster to Sheila, nodded at Clement. Y'all take care of one another, you hear? All around us, the Christmas lights popped on. Now, I said, tugging the crumpled song sheet from my jacket, what's next on the ticket? Thanks for listening. To contribute to Workers' Interfaith Network, a charity faithfully seeking justice with workers, please follow the link at can'tdonothingwithlove.wordpress.com or visit workersinterfaithnetwork.org. Message me on Facebook at Can't Do Nothing With Love. Our music, The Lights of Home, was written and sung by Mr. Rob Pate. Rock on, Rob.
Oh, he's the light of home. Thank you. Thank you very much.